Welcome to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV, featuring inspiring conversations with activists, community leaders, and others working to make our world a better place. I'm Maeve Conran, and on today's show, the intersection of voting rights and economic and racial justice. Taifa Smith-Butler is the new president of Demos, a progressive think tank aimed at creating a just, inclusive, multiracial democracy and economy for all. Demos is calling on Congress to pass the For the People Act, saying this transformative voting rights bill has racial justice at its core and would expand political power in Black and Brown communities. From Free Speech TV, Just Solutions. The two tenets of the work that you're doing at Demos is democratic reform and economic justice. As we heard there in the introduction, the For the People Act, which on the surface is a voting rights bill, so around democratic reform. As you are saying at Demos, it also has economic justice at its core. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. And first of all, Maeve, thanks for having me here today. We can't have political power without economic power. And so that's been a tenet, strong tenet of Demos, is to really think about, as we try to expand access to the franchise, voting rights for Black and Brown people in this country who have been most marginalized in our democracy. And as we see today, they continue to be. But we also have to think about that political power, that voice must also have an economic voice and economic power. And we see the two hand in hand, that in order for Black and Brown people to really have voice and thrive in this country, we've got to marry economic power with political power. And so voting rights access to the franchise is important, but also we've got to think about the economic justice, the pocketbook issues to also address today.
When we talk about the For the People Act, so many people reference the voter suppression tactics that are currently in play. We're seeing so much legislation being introduced and passed in states all around the country that saw record turnout of voters of color. So when we look at these voter suppression issues, what are you most concerned about, particularly when we tie it to economic justice?
So what I've seen, particularly in the 20 years that I've been working in the South, is that we've oftentimes used the excuse that people are apathetic about government or apathetic about what's happening, but we haven't put our finger on the fact that there are a host of barriers that have been put in place so that people cannot engage. And so when we get a historic moment like we saw last year, where tens of millions of Americans, particularly people of color, Black and Brown folks, showed up and showed out at the ballot, now it's all of a sudden issues of security or fraud or things like that, when this should be a moment that is applauded. And the response that I see today with the voter suppression bills, I've been calling it an epidemic of voter suppression. And how do we address this long lasting tentacle that has been in our democracy, where we really don't want diversity of voice and thought in our election process, in our democratic process? And what are the ways that we've continued to put these barriers in place for those most marginalized in our economy and our democracy to continue to stay silent? So we've got to address this long term through the For the People Act and for the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. These are critical tenets to make sure that the onslaught that we're seeing at the state level, which again is baked in white supremacy and fear mongering among this electorate, is to make sure that we've got a federal piece of legislation that can squash and stymie all of these state-based suppressionist tactics. We need the federal legislation to make sure that everyone has access. If we're not going to pass a constitutional right to vote, then we need this federal type of legislation to improve.
Well, let's dig in a little more to exactly what the For the People Act would do and how it would, you know, support those voters of color. I know voting by mail was a huge issue because of COVID. And there are states like Colorado that had successfully and safely done elections all by mail for many years that led the way. This is one of the areas that we're seeing being attacked essentially and being targeted by some of these voter suppression bills. Take us through why something like voting by mail is so important
for voters of color and those voters who have traditionally been marginalized at the ballot box?
Absolutely. Well, you think about just the time it takes for people to go to an election precinct to mail in their ballot or to go and actually vote, to have access, particularly in the period of the pandemic, to be able to get an absentee ballot, apply for it, get it at home, fill it out and take it to a post office box to mail in your vote and be participating is really important. And that was huge during this election cycle. Many elderly people of color, those who live in rural communities, this is a huge way to make sure that there's equitable access to have their voice counted. And these are the things that are being now seen as problematic when in the past, mail-in votes or absentee mail was largely a white tool. A tool used by predominantly white people in rural communities, elderly, to use the mail-in ballot. And now all of a sudden, when people of color employ it during a pandemic, now it's seen as one of those things that are problematic. So that, I think, is one of the core pieces of the For the People Act that is important to expand and protect vote by mail. Also, same-day registration, online registration. Those are the things that, again, make it much more accessible and removes those barriers for people who can't quite get to a ballot, to a precinct on voting election day. And I think also what's important to see is I've talked to people across the South in particular, is, you know, when people are working 2 and 3 jobs just to make ends meet and the amount of time that they have to go to the polls, whether or not early voting is extended, the opportunities they have to actually physically show up and be in long lines all day, people don't have time for that. So I think this act would also help ensure additional days of early voting and, you know, weekend voting. Those kinds of things that are baked into our system can really help Black and Brown folks who struggle to get to the polls.
I think that's such a great point that you make, that that's truly the intersection of economic justice and democracy there, because for so many people, it's an economic decision to take hours off your day to go stand in line. Potentially childcare could be an issue. Even transportation to the polls could be an issue. And yet we're seeing some of these voter suppression bills really getting to targeting the very core of that. And in Georgia, this issue, this bill being that was introduced to make it a crime to provide water or any kind of sustenance for people standing in long lines at the polls, that really is essentially targeting those low-income people where it's a much bigger effort for them to cast a vote than somebody, say, in an urban area that has access to voting by mail.
Absolutely. And I think the tactics that we've seen in Georgia and in the South where, you know, these precincts that are heavily dominated in Black and Brown communities, where there are 2 and 3 machines, you know, for the population, and that then creates the 8-hour wait for people. It's unacceptable. So when we think about infrastructure, the amount of funding that is needed to make it more equitable across all of our precincts, so people don't have this disparity in wait time, you know, those are the things that also I think can be secured.
What are some of the other concerns that you have right now? I know the filibuster is something that we've explored extensively on this show, has been raised as an issue that is just basically an impediment to passing any progressive legislation, including the For the People Act. And I know Demos is weighing in on this, also exploring the racist history of the filibuster, how it has been used to target civil rights legislation. What are your main concerns when it comes to the filibuster?
That it continues to be a relic of our racist past and our racist history. And it continues to be a tool for white supremacy to reign supreme. If you look at how we've advanced, I would say in the progressive space, these transformative policies like gun rights and minimum wage increase and the DREAM Act to improve opportunities for immigrants to have citizenship. All of these things lay at the feet of the filibuster. And we have an opportunity in this moment in time to really address how that tool has been problematic from day one and remove it so that we can advance more of the solutions that will help the broader electorate. And my concern today is that we can't I would say there has to be the political will, and I to remove the filibuster. There is surely public will for it, and I think as we hold these lawmakers accountable for using that tool to stymie the progress that the broader electorate wants, there needs to be a response to me that shows up at the ballot box. However, when we continue to stymie and create more barriers for people to access the polls, that's almost like a tool that will keep them in those seats. So to me, if we could get rid of the filibuster and really advance all of these bills that are sitting in the Senate that could really address the challenges that we see in Black and Brown communities, where gun violence is some of the most challenging things that face Black and Brown communities, looking at student debt, looking at the disparities in pay, where the raising the federal minimum wage could really be a way to raise the floor that could spark state level changes in addition to corporate changes in minimum wage and just fair pay. So those are the things that I think could really be levers that this government can use. But the filibuster is certainly being used as a tool to stymie that progress.
When we talk about voting rights and we talk about big pieces of legislation like the For the People Act and, of course, then the filibuster, there's often a tendency, I think, then for us to focus on just the federal elections, of course, the presidential, the Senate, the congressional elections. But these voter suppression acts and protections that would be afforded by the For the People Act have much broader implications for local elections, for city council, county commissioner, your state house. And those elections very often have a much greater impact on people's day-to-day lives, including their economic lives as well. So maybe talk a little bit about that, about why this is such an integral thing when we talk about the wide-ranging implication of disenfranchising thousands and thousands of voters.
Absolutely. That's such a great point. And we saw that here locally as well, that in order to get different representation, people have to have the power to put different people in those seats and also be able to not be beholden to the corporate influence and the money in politics that really has limited their ability to have a say in who's making the decisions that impact their lives. And so really thinking about this small dollar democracy to really enable people to be able to have more publicly driven campaigns, public finance campaigns that can help talk about diversify the look and the feel of who's representing the people. I think that is a tremendous way to also build more economic power and political power to Black and Brown communities, by actually having people who are sitting in those seats with the lived experience of the community who can then think about governing and think about policy solutions that really touch their constituents. And I think that's an important piece that we have to think about. Because again, as we think about democracy today and the amount of corporate influence and the amount of wealth that is influencing the decisions that people are making, we have to break that up. And I think the For the People Act would be a specific way that we can get to really democratizing who is representing the people.
You're listening to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV that features inspiring conversations with activists, community leaders, and others who are working to make our world a better place. Today, we're looking at the intersection of voting rights and economic and racial justice with our guest, Taifa Smith-Butler, the new president of Demos, a progressive think tank which is calling on Congress to pass the For the People Act. Big part of your work has been economic justice. And August 3rd, it was Black Women Equal Pay Day. Take us through exactly what that means, because we have Equal Pay Day for white women, for Black women, for Latinx women. Take us through exactly what it means and why August 3rd was selected.
Yes, August 3rd is the day that symbolizes the gender pay gap that we see in this country, where for every $1 a white male makes, a Black woman earns $63. And so for the income that a white male would earn in 2020, it would take 19 months or up to August 3rd for a Black woman to earn the same amount of money. And what we're really trying to show is the stark inequity that is baked into our economy particularly for Black women. October is the date for Latinx women. And we have to really address this gender pay gap and why it is important. As we think about long-term generational wealth, this affects Black families. For example, one of the data points that we've lifted up is that in a 40-year career, you know, $1 million less is what a Black woman would make because of this pay disparity. A Black woman would have to work well into her 80s compared to a white man who would have to work maybe into his 60s. So you talk about the long-term effects of being in the labor force, but also the long-term effects on just wealth in general and what that means for generations down the road. And for Demos, you know, for us to talk about an inclusive economy where Black and Brown communities and people can thrive, we've got to address this inequity that is baked into our system. And it has been there since day one when we have devalued Black labor from jump, you know, in terms of chattel slavery, in terms of America's original sin of racism, and that Black skin and Black bodies aren't worthy of pay and are not valued. And that has consistently borne out in our labor laws that have been passed, where the workforce, where Black folks typically were domestic workers, agricultural workers, they were not covered in those labor protections. And so those are continuing to persist as we see in this gender pay gap.
When we talk about that aspect of the intergenerational impact on that, I think that is such an important point to make, particularly when we talk about economic justice, that there have been policies that have been baked into the very core of this country that have excluded communities of color, and particularly Black families, from amassing any type of intergenerational or family wealth, particularly through home ownership. And that's had a devastating impact on people's ability to advance. You can't borrow against a home you don't own to potentially send your children to college or to advance in other ways. And we've covered this on Just Solutions, where Black women are disproportionately bearing the largest brunt of student debt of any demographic in this country. I think it's really important when we talk about these economic issues that we look at that broader intergenerational aspect, because so much of the narrative, I think, in this country is that, well, if you work hard enough, you will succeed. And so if you're not succeeding, that's somehow a problem that you're not working hard enough, as opposed to looking at the broader multi-generational policies that have stopped people from realizing their full potential.
Absolutely. And this broader conservative meta narrative around a personal responsibility, as if it is the fault of Black and Brown people that they're not getting paid equitably, or that, you know, the two jobs that they're making is not enough for them to support their families. But when we look at the gender pay gap, particularly for Black women's equal pay day, when we see across the board, regardless of occupation, women are paid less. So a woman who has pursued a medical degree and is a surgeon, she is making still less than her white male counterpart as a surgeon who's gone to medical school, has done a residency. And so again, when you think about if both of those folks took debt out to go to school, her pay is going to be, you know, less than a white male, and may take her longer to pay that student debt off. These are systemic issues that have to be addressed that create this inequity that we see. And it, as you said, Maeve, it was born from the housing policies that were created that did not allow Black folks to own homes, from the banking policies and the redlining that took place that also disproportionately affected where Black folks could live and also get home ownership. I love some of the writings and the resources that have really helped us understand this better with Richard Rothstein's, you know, Color of Law and when Affirmative Action Was White. Like, those books and that body of work has really helped us see the historical policy choices that were made in favor of white people in this country. And all we're saying right now is, as we think about this pandemic and the disproportionate effect it had on Black and Brown people last year in particular, where Black folks, brown folks were in the jobs that were most impacted by the shuttering of businesses, the retail industry, hospitality, you know, those low level positions, the restaurant industry, where folks are not paid and they don't have a say in terms of healthcare and their scheduling. So they still had to show up in the, amid a pandemic, put their bodies and life on the line to serve others. Black folks have been on this hamster wheel from day one, creating generational wealth for other people, creating assets and capital for other people. What we're asking for now is the government, who was the proponent of this inequity, is to fix it and to make sure that all the things that we think about now going forward, that policy has a racial equity goal. And these things around pay, the pay gap, fair wages, living wages, child tax credits, tax, amending the tax code to support people who are struggling to get to the middle class. Those are the kinds of things that can help Black and brown people fare better. And I would say also is, you know, when we think about power in this country, we have not given workers voice. You know, I live in a right to work state. Many of us live in a right to work state. So when we think about economic justice and the government creating better opportunities for folks to have voice in their work environments, the PRO Act is one of those clear ways that would give folks the right to organize, to get better scheduling, better pay, better working conditions, so that they too can benefit from this work and this labor that they're putting in for this country every day.
To tie all of this back to, you know, what we started talking about, the For the People Act and the need to have strong voter protections in place so that people can be represented and people can have their voices heard when it comes to our elections. When you do have governance that acknowledges the systemic racism that exists, we then see policies put in place that can tackle it. And right now, the massive infrastructure bill actually has quite a large component that acknowledges the racial equity and the racial inequity. Pete Buttigieg, the transportation secretary, actually back in April described our highway system as, well, he said it's racism is built in to our infrastructure, talking about racist highways. Now, he was laughed at almost by some Republican lawmakers who said, no, it's just a road. But if we look at how highways were created and dividing literally communities of color, particularly urban Black communities, and what that did then to the economics of those communities, we can start to connect all those dots. So talk a little bit about that, about maybe some of the corrective measures that we're seeing and what more we need to see.
Absolutely. You know, again, if people were just students of history, and I mean really, to go back and look at some of these things, it would be crystal clear and obvious that the policy choices that were made were in essence racist policies, that they disproportionately affected Black people, brown people, communities of color across this country. I mean, when I see here in Atlanta and other places in the South where every highway, especially when the big highway bill was passed, they cut right through Black businesses, Black communities, where there was burgeoning wealth that was being generated by Black and brown communities. And I love what Dr. Kendi says in his work around how to be an anti-racist, is that any bill, any legislation that creates inequity for a racial group is a racist policy. And what we need to do today, for example, with this infrastructure bill that is naming the inequities and the wrongs of history with the policy choices that this government has made and is now saying we are going to invest in transit, we're going to invest in transportation and build roads and bridges. And I say this is a moment where government needs to also ensure that the people have a say in where those funds get spent, because there is a huge distrust in Black and brown communities of government today. When they saw those funds come into their community for the highways, but then they tore up their communities. So there's no wonder that, you know, the people, the demos, are looking at government with a side eye and skepticism about these kinds of initiatives. Are they really going to benefit our folks in our community? Or are they just talking out of both sides of their mouth and they're going to continue to create the inequities that we see? So I think there's huge opportunities to invest in transit in communities. We saw with the pandemic, particularly in the South, where there was very poor infrastructure for broadband and how Black students were disproportionately affected in these schools that had no broadband access to be remote. So there's a way that we can level the playing field by making these kinds of infrastructure investments. And it counters the broader narrative around austerity and the scarcity frame. Because we've seen far too often that we're quick, our political leaders are quick and okay with passing all kinds of tax credits and tax breaks to the very top. But when we're talking about investing in infrastructure and programs that could really bolster the lives of the broader electorate, particularly those challenged and trying to get to the middle class, those are the things that seem wasteful. So I would just continue to encourage our lawmakers that this bill, this infrastructure package that's now going to the House, is one step to really make sure that we can bolster our economy and make sure that it's more inclusive for Black and Brown folks. But we cannot sleep on these voter bills. They have to go hand in hand. The Senate has to come back and do the job, because if we don't, we will not see the power that is necessary in this country for Black and Brown people. And that's what is critical as we move toward a nation that is majority people of color, where the income inequality continues to grow, the chasm between the have and the have nots, the wealthy and those struggling to make ends meet, that continues to grow. So we have to have a broader policy response to help.
And of course, then so much of the decision making around where those funds will be spent will be happening at a local governmental level. So this goes back to the fact that if people feel disenfranchised from the entire election system, they're not going to show up to those meetings where they can maybe have their voice heard when it comes to this local spending. In the last few minutes that we have, Taifa, I heard Representative Ayanna Pressley saying, I think it was in relation to the infrastructure bill, that we are at an inflection point of governance right now. We have opportunity and also a lot of challenges. You're now taking the helm of Demos at this inflection point. You know, what do you see in terms of how this inflection point is playing out and what we need to do to make sure that it plays out with the progressive agenda, with this racial equity at its core?
Yes, I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be able to be in this position, but also how, the trepidation, because we are in an incredible moment, to your point. And I think we at Demos, as we're even dreaming and thinking now about what are the things that we need to do, leaning on our 20-year history of this intersection of democracy reform, inclusive economy, racial justice, Black and Brown lives, and thrive, that they can thrive in this country and be liberated from this oppressive economy that we've seen. What are the things that we need to do? How do we lean into our strengths? And again, bringing sort of our litigation arm, our research and our policy solutions to the table that we've been doing for over 20 years now, that can really help govern in this moment, but also our connection to movement. You know, and as we think about our work going forward, where we are about the power of the people, how do we make sure that we are working within this progressive ecosystem and in the movement to build and bring the ideas that are coming from the field so that we can push on this governing agenda and make sure that our lawmakers and our policymakers are accountable to the people. And I think right now, given, this administration that we're working with, we're seeing the opportunity, but we need to continue to press, to dream, to think transformation. Yes, incrementalism comes. We understand that there are the small steps that need to be taken to get to our bigger ends, but we've got to dream big to fix these issues that we've seen perpetuate historically. And Maeve, I've said this, we cannot go back to status quo. Everybody's so quick to hit the reset button and go back to yesterday, to go back to normal. But we know yesterday and normal was riddled with flaws in this economy and our democracy. And we must reset it and rebuild it and remake it so that there is power that is coming from Black and brown people who can name the dreams and aspirations they want for their people, and that those who are making those decisions look like them, they hear them, and they improve their livelihood. And that's what we want to see at Demos.
You've been listening to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV. Today's guest was Taifa Smith Butler, the new president at the progressive think tank Demos. They're calling on Congress to pass the For the People Act. Find out more about their work at demos.org. That's demos.org. Find out more about us and watch past episodes at freespeech.org and engage with us on social media. Join the conversation. Let us know your thoughts at Free Speech TV. Subscribe to this podcast and never miss an episode. For Free Speech TV, Just Solutions, I'm Maeve Conran.